Let's open our Bibles. We'll be in Genesis chapter 37. Genesis, continuing in our study. When I first came to the Lord, I thought as what I think a lot of people think, and that is that when you come to the Lord, you immediately become nice. I thought that. I thought, in fact, one of the reasons I almost didn't come to the Lord was because I wasn't sure I wanted to be that nice. After I came to the Lord, I realized coming to Him doesn't make you nice. In fact, sometimes He picks up the really unnicest people He can find and puts them in to the body of Christ. And He delights to use them. He delights to change their lives. But they're not changing fast enough for me. Have you noticed that? The unnice people around you don't change fast enough for you. And the difficulties of being part of the family of God sometimes mount up. It's at times like that that I remember the chapters we're going to study this evening. Because these two chapters, 37 and 38 of Genesis, are a great reminder that God is not in the niceness business. He's in the redemption business. And what He's really doing is taking rank sinners, changing them around, remolding their lives, and through His covenant, He is actually developing His life within them. But they're not all at maturity level yet. And we have in these two chapters a couple of the darkest chapters in the Bible. Now, one of them, the first one, chapter 37, is one that the happy ending you know the life of Joseph. But the other one, people are hard-pressed to actually find a happy ending in chapter 38. And we're going to see a little bit of that. But as we move into this, I want you to understand ahead of time that the Lord knows He's working with really kind of tough merchandise when He's dealing with human beings. And He does not shirk that. He does not back away from humanity saying to Gabriel, I just don't know if I can handle this. I mean, these people are really bad. I don't know if I can use all of their mistakes. I don't know if I can deal with all of their sins. He doesn't do that. He wades into the subject matter of sinful humanity, and he does marvelous things with it. And we're going to see how that happens. The covenant family, of course, is Jacob's family. And we're finishing the Jacob narrative in Genesis. We're moving into the Joseph narrative when we get into chapter 37. The Joseph narrative actually goes all the way to the end of the book with one little parenthetical chapter. And it's the next one. It's chapter 38. It's a parenthetical chapter. And we'll see how it fits as we look at it this evening. As we move out of Jacob's story, though he's still alive at this time, and we move into Joseph's story, the year is just a little after the year 2000 BC. Okay, so it's about 19, I think one commentary I read had calculated it at 1998 BC, which is kind of cool because that's, you know, we're at 2000 AD. We're talking almost exactly 4,000 years ago that these things took place. Jacob has brought his large family back from Paddan Aram. He went there just as a single guy, essentially. Came back with four wives. Actually, two wives and two concubines. And 12 sons and a daughter. The 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel, as you know. These are the 12 patriarchs. Now, you might think this would be a good church-going family with very few difficulties. Such is not the case. If you know the story of the patriarchal family, you know how dysfunctional and downright crazy-making it really was in these homes. Every generation from Abraham had crazy-makers in it, and they made crazies all around them. And we're going to see some of that this evening. These boys did not get along. By the way, their age, as we look into this, is that the oldest one is about 30. That would be Reuben. He's the eldest. He's about 30. And the rest of them are in their 20s. Joseph is about 17. Benjamin is quite a bit younger than that. He's a young boy at this point in time. They are shepherds. They are young agricultural businessmen. They work for their father, Jacob. They run the family business. Jacob stays home at headquarters. And he is in the habit of sending his favorite son, Joseph, who was the son of his favorite wife, Rachel, who had died in childbirth with Benjamin. She had only two sons, and she died in childbirth with Benjamin. But the first of her two sons is Jacob's favorite, and he's in the habit of letting Jacob, Joseph, who's only 17, actually kind of run the business from a distance. Joseph, because he is Jacob's favorite, goes out and checks on the flocks out where they are. The other men, several of them, are actually doing a lot of the work out in the fields, and they're running the crews, and they're taking care of the sheep and whatever else. And as we look into it, these are, just remember, they're young half-brothers. A bunch of them are half-brothers. They've got four mothers, but one father. So it's all one family, but there's some clannishness within the clan. And there are some real personality conflicts, as you will see as we look into this. It would not have been a happy family to be a part of, I don't think. And you'll see how that begins to work out. Let's begin with chapter 37, verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. And these are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when he was 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel, that's Jacob's other name, loved Joseph more than all of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varicolored tunic. That can also be a full-length tunic. It depends on how you render the word in Hebrew, either full-length or varicolored. Either way, a tunic with a great deal of honor attached to it, and an opportunity for young Joseph to be well thought of. And at least one person we know of thought very well of young Joseph, and that was Joseph. As we will see, his brothers didn't share the high opinion that he had or that his father had of him. He had this tunic. He was very proud of it, and his brothers are out there. He comes out probably strutting. Now, I'm saying that just it doesn't say he strutted, but when you read what he says to his brothers and you hear what's going on, you kind of get a feeling for the way he related to his brothers. I don't think he was a terrible guy, but I think he knew he was the favorite. And I think that really set a few things in motion. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the rest of them. Verse 4, and so they hated him, and they couldn't speak to him on friendly terms. I want you to notice a few things about this young man. He was responsible and he was trustworthy, but he was arrogant. He was responsible and he was trustworthy. Even at the age of 17, his dad trusted him to manage, not run everything, but go out and tell him what was going on, which means that Jacob really couldn't trust some of his other sons. Well, now that's really not hard to understand if you remember a little bit about his other sons. Remember that Reuben had taken one of Jacob's concubines at one point in time. And Jacob hadn't said anything, but he hadn't forgotten it. And we know, because clear by the end of Jacob's life, he actually curses Reuben for that deed that was done so many years ago. So Reuben's not an especially trustworthy man. And Simeon and Levi, they're not the welcome wagon, my friend. If you remember what they did to Shechem, they completely destroyed a city, the two of them and their servants. The next one in line was Judah, and we're going to read a little more about Judah in chapter 38. Now, it seems that Jacob had reason to trust young Joseph because he was responsible, he was accountable, but interestingly, he was also arrogant. And I want to point out that very often, strange as it may seem, arrogance goes along with responsibility and trustworthiness. People who tend to be very trustworthy and responsible tend to be a bit arrogant about the fact that they are that way. And I don't mean just because they might have nicer clothing, although they might, because people who have those characteristics might actually succeed in business and might actually make a little more money and might actually have the trappings of success. And that doesn't help when it comes to the arrogance department. But I mean that there's a kind of a personal arrogance when you know you're good at something and when you know that other people know that you're good at something. And interestingly, when that happens, there is an arrogance that looks down on other people who might not be as good as you are at that. And the fact is, you know you're better than they are at that one thing. I don't mean better in terms of God's sight, but you know you've got a skill. You know you've got something going for you. And when you make decisions, there's wisdom in it, and you've got some strength of character. You know that's there. These aren't bad things. These are good things. But they're good things that can lead to a spirit of pride and arrogance, and that is a bad thing. And that can undermine the other good things that are there. Very interesting how that works. In the New Testament, it's called, we call it, the Big Brother Syndrome. Because big brothers are sort of chronically responsible, I know by experience, because I am one. Big brothers tend to be type A, chronically responsible people. Little brothers tend to be the ones who run away with the father's wealth. Which I've explained to my little brothers on more than one occasion. You remember how in the parable of the prodigal, he ran away with dad's wealth and squandered it in a foreign country, came back, and his dad was glad to see him, and the older brother was ticked. He was ticked off that dad was glad to see him. The older brother syndrome, the chronically responsible person. And the father had said to him, if you remember it in Luke 15, the father had said to that older brother, listen, everything I have is yours. He's not ragging on him. He's just explaining himself. Everything I have is yours. I know you've been here the whole time. I know you're responsible. It's okay. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're responsible, but let me have some joy because this is my son who's come home, you see. And the explanation, of course, is about how the Lord welcomes sinners, despite the fact that the chronically responsible people who never fell into that much sin, they think, might be upset about the Lord's low standards of forgiveness. See, it's funny how it works. You know, we Christians should be responsible people, and they very often are, but they can easily fall into arrogance about that responsibility. It needs to be guarded against. There's another thing about him that you'll notice right here in these first few verses. He was chosen and he was gifted, but he was also a bit spoiled. He's the only one who got the coat. You would think that Jacob would have learned. Do you remember Jacob's home life? How his dad had a favorite and it wasn't Jacob. It was Esau. Isaac had a favorite. It was Esau, and he made it very clear he loved Esau more than he loved Jacob. You would think that Jacob, having been the recipient of a sort of one-sided kind of love like that, would not have fallen into the same trap, but he did fall into it. I mean, if you've got 12 sons and you know there's already family competition, you don't have just 12 sons. You've got four wives and 12 sons. That's four whole households, okay? You would think he would want to do everything you could to reduce the competitive nature of these young men. And poor Jacob, he doesn't do that at all. He buys one of his kids this incredibly wonderful coat. And the kid has the gall to wear it out in front of his brothers while he's going to tattle on them for the rotten things they're doing. He's gifted, and he is chosen. We're going to find that out. God has a special plan for him. On the other hand, he tends to be a little spoiled. And sometimes gifted and chosen people can be spoiled. They need to guard against it. They need to guard against it. They need to guard against the idea that they really ought to get the coat all the time. They need to, yeah, you're gifted, and yeah, you're called, and yeah, you've got all, but you don't always get the coat. You got to guard against the idea that you always ought to get the coat and that everybody else ought to always know that you get the coat. Got to guard against that. And we as parents and people who live together in a fallen world need to guard against spoilage. Spoilage of ourselves and spoilage of one another, I think. Another thing you'll notice about him, and it'll kind of set the stage for what else we learn in the lines to come, but he's destined for honor. He is destined for honor. You know the story. Most of you know the story very well of Joseph. But he's also destined for intense tempering. And I use the term tempering because it's what they do to metal. When they heat it and cool it and heat it and cool it. It's bad enough to be heated like that. But to be heated and cooled and heated and cooled and heated and cooled so that you can keep an edge. That, if you ask the metal, it's got to complain about that. Don't you think? You know the Marine Corps ad where they have the guy standing there with the sword and they show this tempering process? I don't know if they still use that advertisement. It was on TV a while back. Where you can see them tempering this steel. And then it becomes this sword. And it's, of course, you know, the metaphor is all there. You know, if you want to be tempered, you know, join the Marine Corps and so on. I remember that about being a Christian and about being a person for whom God has plans. If you say, I want you to have plans for me, Lord, well, then you have to understand there will be some tempering because he doesn't use untempered steel to do the really big things. Tempering happens, and there's the heat and the cooling, and the heat and the cooling. It's a long process, and the process is there so that the person will be able to keep the edge, so that they'll be useful. Well, this is what's going to happen to Joseph, and we'll see how it happens in the weeks to come as we finish the book of Genesis. But as we see Joseph come on the scene, I want you to understand the flaws in this young man in the early going. I don't think he's a perfect guy. And I think his brothers knew full well he wasn't perfect. I want you to see his flaws, but I also want you to see God's tempering process in him. And if you'll just lay that over what you know happens to him in Egypt, you realize that in that next 22 years, it's going to happen from the time he's 17 until he's about 29 or 30. All that tempering is going to be taking place. So I want you to feel that as you see him walk on the stage here. This is the beginning of his narrative. And he's walking on the stage, and he doesn't know any of these things are really going to happen yet. But we do as we look at it. So bear these things in mind. Well, there he is. He's got his coat, and he's going to go talk to his brothers here in a few minutes. Now, Joseph had a dream, verse 5. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, listen, I had a dream. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf. You know what sheaves are, of course? They're the stacks of the stalks of grain, right? We were binding sheaves in the field, all of us together, and lo, mine stood up. And behold, all of your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Is this wisdom? Was he wearing his coat when he said this? I mean, what? Who in their right mind would come and say this? This is a young man who needs some diplomacy lessons or something. Oh, hey, you guys, you're going to be so excited about my dream. I mean, it's so obvious, you know. I had this dream that you're all going to worship me. Ah, I'm sure. Verse 8, and the brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams, for his words. Now, he had another dream. And he related it to his brothers. Now, see, the first one, we might have thought, well, he's just an innocent young guy who's real excited about the dream and didn't know his brothers might be upset with him. But then after that response from his older brothers, he comes back with another dream. Neener, I had another one. And he related it to his brothers. He said, listen, I've had still another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. 11, count them. One to Reuben and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. There's 11 and the sun and the moon. That's dad and mom. Huh. Now, mom's already dead, but this represents mom. The moon here represents mom. So it's like, wow, aren't you guys excited about this? Well, even his dad wasn't excited. Verse 10, he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come and bow down ourselves to the ground before you? You've got to be kidding. That's the idea. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his mind. Very interesting. You can hear Jacob thinking to himself, my son, you know, the coat has kind of gone to your head. What are you talking about here? And he hears about these dreams. But then he kind of tucks them away back in his mind. You know, parents do this, don't they? You listen to things, you watch things with your kids, you listen to what they say, and you tuck certain things back in your mind, and you never forget them. You never forget them. You forget a lot of other stuff. Praise the Lord, you do forget a lot of stuff about your kids. But every once in a while, there's something that somebody says or that they say, and you tuck that away in the back of your mind, and years later, something happens, and you smile, and you say, I kind of thought something like that might happen. It's kind of a wonderful thing about being a parent. It's not always correct. I always thought my son would go to jail. No. It's not always what you look for. So anyway, his dad says, come on, son, get off it. But then he tucks that saying away in verse 11. Verse 12, his brothers went to pasture their flock in Shechem. Now, these guys are down in Hebron, the area around Hebron. By the way, this is before Isaac passed away. So there's several generations represented here. This is a bit of a flashback. You know, we already did Isaac's funeral, but This story actually starts before Isaac passed away, that the whole clan is back down there in Hebron. Now, Shechem is 50, count them, 50 miles north of Hebron. Now, I know it takes a lot of room to graze sheep, but you got to go 50 miles away to graze sheep. You can't find any pasturage in all the hills between Hebron and Shechem, which is clear up in the middle of Israel. I wonder, don't you wonder when you read stuff like this, don't you wonder if there might be some family dynamics going on, like the other sons are saying to themselves, how far can we go away from Joseph? How far can we get away from the little snitch who might be looking for us to see if we do anything wrong and go back and tell Dad? 50 miles. I hear there's some pretty good pasturage up in Shechem. Maybe they forgot that we killed everybody up there a few years ago. Huh? Let's go up there. Well, that's what they do. I don't know if that was all in their thinking, but that's where they went. They went to Shechem to pasture their flocks. Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come on, I'm going to send you up to him. And he said, okay. Says, I'll go. 17-year-old young man. He's going to travel 50 miles on foot up to Shechem to check on the flocks. He said to him, go now, see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. The man said, what are you looking for? So, okay, the scene fades. Now he's up in Shechem where they ought to be, and he figures he knows where they ought to be, and he's walking around, and he can't find them, and day two and day three, and he's already taken several days to get up there. So he's looking all over for him, and he can't find him. And another guy sees him. He says, young man, what are you doing? What are you looking for? Well, I'm looking for my brothers. Verse 16, tell me where they are. Tell me where they're pasturing the flock. He said, oh, well, they were here for a while, but they moved on. I heard him say, let's go to Dothan. Now, Dothan's another 10 mile, 15, actually, some people estimate 20 miles north of Shechem. So it wasn't far enough. Let's go to Dothan. And so he went up to Dothan and found them. So they're not where they belong anyway. They told Dad they were going to Shechem. Did you ever tell your dad you're going somewhere and then go somewhere else? I don't know about these guys. I know they're not really trustworthy. I got to wonder if maybe there were like parties up at... There were lots and lots of towns all around here, okay? All around these areas. They were all Canaanite towns. And you wonder. You just wonder. It doesn't say anything. But here they are. They're not where they're supposed to be. I got to believe that Joseph notes that in his pocket computer to refer to when he gets back to report on what was going on. Came to Shechem, they weren't here. They'd gone another 20 miles north to Dothan. Well, they saw him coming, verse 18. They saw him from a distance before he came close to him, and they plotted against him to put him to death. You can just hear the teeth gritting here, verse 19. And they said to one another, well, here comes Mr. Dreamer. That's exactly the way it reads. Here comes the Dreamster. Okay, Mr. Cool Coat himself. Look, there he is. Okay, let's kill him. Verse 20. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him in one of these pits. Now, incidentally, there are pits in Dothan. Dothan has been excavated. They've dug it up. They found a couple pits. And you want to know something interesting? They found skeletons in both of the pits, both of the cisterns that they uncovered in Dothan. None of them were labeled Joseph. Now, actually, they couldn't possibly have been Joseph's. He lived through it. But apparently it was the idea that you could throw people's bodies into these cisterns. Cisterns were normally to catch water from the rain, which really makes you wonder about the conditions of drinking water in the ancient world. They found, of course, the skeletons that they found in there were not 4,000 years old. That would just be dust at this point. But apparently it's a history of they'd knock somebody on the head, toss him in a big pit or in a big cistern. That's what these guys are suggesting. Here he comes. Let's just kill him. Now, here again, I wonder why they want to do this. Could it be that they know he's going to report back to their father? This is a dangerous thing, to kill somebody. It's dangerous. I am only speculating. Feel free to disagree with me, but I suspect that there was something going on up there that had to do with their moving around and being so far from Dad that they were afraid he was going to find. and that if he found it and he told Dad, there'd be more trouble, so much trouble that they'd be willing to face the trouble of killing him, which is a pretty high price to pay. I don't know what they were doing up there, but it must not have been something really too good for them to think that they needed to kill their brother. Or maybe it was just that they hated him. If that's true, then it doesn't speak any better for their character anyway. Either situation is pretty bad in terms of understanding these men at this time. Here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him, toss him in a pit, and then we'll say that the wild beast devoured him. And then let's see what becomes of his stupid dreams. Yeah, ribble, rabble, rabble. Verse 21. There's the Hebrew for ribble, rabble, isn't there? I had to add that. Verse 21, and Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands. And he said, no, we let's not take his life, said Reuben. Now, Reuben's the oldest, and we find out later that Reuben was actually in charge. He was actually supposed to take care of the youngest. So he said, no, don't take his life. Reuben further said to them, don't shed blood. Throw him into the pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him. And he was doing this because he was going to come back and rescue him. See the last part of verse 22? He's going to come back and rescue him out of their hands and restore him to his father. Now the question is, why didn't Reuben do something about it more forcefully? Why didn't he just say, you can't do this? Joseph, turn around, go home, tell Dad that everything's fine, but get out of here. And then kind of stand against his brothers or do something. Why didn't he do, why the deception? Throw him in the pit, then I'll come back later tonight. I'll come get him or whatever, and I'll secretly take him home. Probably because he was afraid of his brothers too. Probably because there's a lot of them, and they've got servants. It's not just them. There's a whole bunch of guys out there. And they're all loyal. They're all these little groups of guys, you know. And he's probably thinking, you know, I don't want to get in a tangle. They might bop me on the head and say they devoured me too. So he says, just throw him in the pit. He's thinking to himself, I'm going to come rescue him later, which is a good thing that he thought this. Incidentally, years later, when Joseph is essentially, for all intents and purposes, the king of Egypt, and you know the story, I'm not telling anything you don't already know, but Reuben, when the brothers came and Joseph wanted a hostage, so to speak, he could have taken Reuben and he didn't. It's interesting. Could have taken Reuben, and he didn't. And I think he remembered that Reuben intended to help him. He may have told him. Reuben may have said, just hold tight here, son. Just take it easy. Well, I'll make sure you get out of this. Well, it didn't quite work out the way Reuben intended. Verse 23, so it came about when Joseph reached his brothers, and they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the varicolored tunic that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. The cistern was empty. And they sat down to eat a meal. You know, it's amazing how callous people can be. Can you imagine this? You throw your brother into this, just toss him into this thing. Who knows whether he hurt himself badly as he fell to the bottom or whatever. And he's no doubt yelling back there, down there. In chapter 42, when they show up and they see Joseph again and they don't know who he is, it's interesting because they have this conversation at that time, which is 20 years later after these events. They have this conversation with each other, and one of the things they say is, I'm paraphrasing, but they said, this is the judgment of God on us for what we did to our brother Joseph 20 years ago. They never forgot it. They never forgot it. And you know what else they say in that section? They say, we heard him pleading and crying for mercy. So that's what's going on in this scene as these guys sit down to eat. And their brother is pleading with them, crying out for mercy. And he's in the pit. And they don't care. They just hate him. So they raised their eyes and they looked, and behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead. And their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh. And they were on their way to bring them down to Egypt. These were trade routes. This was not a wilderness area all the time. There were caravans that went through here. These were major roads. You didn't have to blaze a trail anywhere. They were regular, what we would call, the equivalent of highways in those days. And so here comes this caravan of Ishmaelites, and they're carrying all their stuff. Verse 26, Judah says to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come on, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, because he's our brother and our own flesh. Oh, what a softy. Judah, what a great idea. Okay, because he's our brother, let's not kill him, let's sell him. Let's sell him as a slave. And his brothers listened to him. And then some of the Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up, lifted him And they lifted Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now, we'll get back to that part in just a moment. But now it fades to Reuben. And when Reuben returned to the pit, behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So apparently Reuben had missed out on the slave sale thing, and the other guys had done it without him. And Reuben comes back to rescue Joseph, and he wasn't in the pit. And he tore his garments. He is panicked now. And he returned to his brothers, and he said, look, the boy's not here. And as for me, where am I going to go? He apparently knew that he'd be blamed for this, and he was the oldest. He was in charge. And his father would hold him responsible for what happened to his little brother. Where am I going to go? And they took Joseph's tunic, and they slaughtered a male goat, and they dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the varicolored tunic, and they brought it back to their father, and they said, look, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. Oh, man, can you see this? They all come in like, whoa, Dad, look what we found. Oh, wow. Gee, whose do you think it is? Wow, look at, there's a lot of blood on it. Of course, no forensic medicine in those days. You couldn't tell if it was animal blood or people blood. And, wow, Dad, what do you think? What do you think this is? And he examined it, and he said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Jumps immediately to the obvious conclusion. So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son for many days. And now look at verse 35. You want to talk sheer hypocrisy. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. These hypocritical, creepy brothers, they're just coming around to, oh, Dad, don't feel so bad. You know, I'm sure, he's in a better place. And they're all these crocodile tears, and they never let on, but they never forgot what they did. It was really something that they carried with them. And it's my conviction that it's why chapter 38 starts with one of these major brothers leaving the clan and going and living somewhere else. Judah leaves. And I think it's because of what he did. But verse 36 gives us a hint. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. And we'll get back to that, and you know what happens to him there. Now the scene shifts back home, back to the ranch. Now for the next 20 years, we don't find out very much of what goes on back here in Hebron and the environs around Hebron. For the next 20 years, beginning in the next chapter, we're just going to follow Joseph's story. But this one account of all that 20 years, this is the only account that we find of what happened back home. And it is not a pretty picture. It's a very odd picture. It's about Judah and Tamar. And it's one of the weirdest chapters. You might, if you look for weird chapters in the Bible, this is a weird one. It came about at that time, or during that period of time, that Judah departed from his brothers, and he visited a certain Adullamite. Adullam was a little town. It wasn't very far from Hebron, 10, 15 miles. He visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he took her, and he went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Now, basically what it means is he took her as a wife. But on the other hand, do you remember what great pains the previous patriarchs have gone to avoid taking Canaanite women as wives? And here's Judah, who's a very important patriarch. Of course, he didn't think, he didn't know what was going to happen in the future, and he just saw himself as a man who needed a wife. But he's not thinking like his father or his grandfather about these things at all. And he takes a Canaanite wife. She conceives and she bears him a son by the name of Ur. And she conceived again and bore another son named by the name of Onan. And she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Kezib that she bore them to him. So he moved up there, and he kind of moves his clan. Like I said before, I think he did it because he wanted to get away from the dysfunction of the family, okay? And while he's up there, he kind of mixes with the Canaanites, but it doesn't work out very well. Verse 7, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. When I first read that, I thought, okay, God took his life because he's evil. And then I thought, how evil would he have to be? Look at the guys in the previous chapter. And God didn't even tweak him. You know, I mean, he didn't even slap him. He didn't say anything to him. How evil is a guy who God says, I'm not going to let him live? He's so evil, I'm not going to let him live. I don't know. It doesn't say. But I'll tell you, it must have been pretty bad. Don't know what was, you know, don't know what kind of a man he was, but he was half Canaanite, and chances are excellent he did not convert to the worship of Yahweh along with his father Judah, and chances are excellent that Judah didn't intend that that should necessarily happen. He married a Canaanite woman. Ur apparently was like his mom, or like their culture anyway. And the Lord took his life. Judah said to Onan, okay, you go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law and raise up offspring for your brother. Levirate marriage, from the Latin term levir, which means brother-in-law. And it was commonly practiced in the ancient world. It's written into the law of Moses, but it was commonly practiced in the ancient world, and it was very important in their world. We think of it as an odd thing, and if you've never heard of it, it takes a little explaining. But when it was so important, everybody knew that a family would turn into a clan, which would turn into a nation eventually. They didn't think in terms of families. They thought in terms of potential nations and inheritance and inhabiting the world. It's something we don't think about in our era because our population is so huge. But in those days, when they had kids and they had families and clans, they saw their world as infinitely expanding. And they saw the world as something they could move into and produce more kids, and the more the better. So that they saw themselves as potential nations. Okay? Very hard for us to grasp this idea. Well, in that kind of a world, and God said he wanted it to be that way, in that kind of a world, if a patriarch died before he could produce offspring, this was terrible. And so they made a way whereby that patriarch could have offspring and the kids would inherit the father's land and so on, just as if he had fathered them, and they did it through levirate marriage. They did it through the brother-in-law. And what he did was, basically, he took her as a wife, and when she had kids, they weren't his kids. They were treated as though they were the children of his brother, and it allowed the family to go on. Well, now the problem with Onan is that he didn't exactly play by the rules. Onan knew that the offspring, verse 9, would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. He was using her for sex, and he was supposedly doing his duty. But the bottom line was, he did not want her to have kids. Why? Because her kids would inherit all the stuff that he would inherit if they weren't there. See? It wasn't just the fact that he wanted to use her for sexual gratification. He didn't want her to have children because that would actually mean his inheritance would be smaller. And so the Lord killed him too. Verse 10. This was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life too. And again, we don't know anything else about Onan except that he did this and that he was cheating his brother. And the Lord said, I don't like that. Verse 11. And Judah said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, look, you know, the guys you marry, they end up dying. And I've only got one left. Now, see, she was supposed to go from one to the next one. And so he says, I tell you what, you remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. He was still a kid. Because he thought to himself, I am afraid that he too is going to die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived at her father's house. Look, Tamar, I like you a lot. You're a good kid. But I've only got one son left, and you're going to need to go stay with your dad. Now, why Judah didn't have any other sons, we don't know. We don't know what his relationship was like with his Canaanite wife. Maybe she couldn't have any more. And he didn't take another wife at this time. And as a matter of fact, she died. His wife died shortly after this. So now we are left with one son, Shelah, Judah, who's a patriarch, but he hasn't got a tribe around him yet, and this estranged daughter-in-law by the name of Tamar. Rather odd situation. Verse 12. After a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers in Timnah, which is, if you drew a straight line from Hebron, right straight through several little towns for about 50 miles, up at the top was Timnah. And he's going up there. It's some distance. And he had a friend up there hire the Adullamite again. So he's going up there to do the sheep shearing. They did a lot of traveling to do their work. Verse 13. And it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, and she covered herself with a veil, and she wrapped herself, and she sat in the doorway, in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. She knew the road, she knew the highways, she knew where all the rest stops were, she knew where all the towns were, and where it was likely that he was going to stop. And she dressed herself up like a hooker. And she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. Now she hatches this plan, not out of spite, but because she knows that she has the right to have the child who will inherit everything from Judah. And that was a substantial amount. Judah had made a deal with her and with her father. That was the way it was done. And she had a vested interest in this. Now, ladies in our era might not connect with how important it was to her to be part of that clan. But once she became part of Judah's clan, she couldn't just go back to her father's household permanently. Her whole identity was going to be found in Judah's clan. And if he did not allow her to marry one of his sons, she would remain barren in that clan until she died. And that's why she hatches a dangerous, dangerous scheme in order to trap Judah into fulfilling the promise. The promise was, you're going to bear a son. That was his original promise to her. You're going to bear a son by my son, and your son will actually inherit everything I have. That was a lot to her. That meant a lot to her. Well, now it comes to the third kid, and then Judah's saying, I don't want to give him to her. And she realizes it. She sees the handwriting on the wall. And she says, well, if I'm going to die an old maid anyway, I'm going to start taking some chances now. And she says, I find out he's going up there. So she dresses herself up like a cult prostitute. And she arranges to meet him or be where he can see her. Judah saw her and he thought it was a harlot, for she had covered her face. Now, these are not just hookers for hire, pardon the earthiness of all of this, but the bottom line is these were cult prostitutes. Fertility cults in Canaan were very, very popular, as you can imagine. And what they would do, in fact, some cities in Canaan, all the women in the whole city were expected at one time or another to serve as cult prostitutes. And they covered themselves with veils, and in the worship of these pagan fertility deities, there was a lot of sexuality involved. And whenever you think back to the fact that God destroyed Canaan completely and told the Jews to utterly wipe them out, I want you to remember that that was a part of their culture, very normal part of their culture. So she knows all of this. She's probably Canaanite, although it doesn't say, but she probably is a Canaanite. And she knows how to dress in order to look like a cult prostitute. So she covers her face and he sees her. And you can just see how this goes. She knows who he is, but she's got a veil. And when you're wearing the veil, it's like wearing really big dark glasses. You can see out, but he can't see in. So she recognizes him. He doesn't know who she is, but she looks very attractive to him. And his wife died a while back. And he's thinking, I'm a long way from home. Maybe nobody will notice if I fool around a little while I'm away from home. He turns aside. He sees her. And he says, she's attractive. And he looks around and he goes and he strikes up a conversation. He says, he propositions her in verse 16. He says, here now, how about you and me get together? And he didn't know it was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what are you going to give me? And he said, well, I'll send you one of the kids from the flock. That was pretty expensive, actually. That was a pretty good price. I'll give you one of the goat kids. And she says, okay, fine, but I need a pledge. I need a down payment. I'm not going to just take your word for it. So they're bargaining here on the side of the road about this little business transaction. He says, what do you want? And she said, I want your seal and your cord and your staff that's in your hand. Now, the seal was his personal signet. It was his signature, and they would use them to sign documents and press it into clay, you know, and so on, a signet. And the cord was what he probably had it hanging on his neck. And easily identifiable as his, and his staff also, easily identifiable as his. And he's figuring, well, you know, I can let her have these for a little while, and then that's my deposit, right? And then when I send the goat up, she'll send me that stuff back, and I guess that'll work. So he gave them to her, and he went into her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garment. So the next day, she's heading back home, and he's on his way to finish whatever he was doing up with Hira. And she goes back home. She doesn't let on. And Judah sent the kid by a friend, by his friend the Adullamite, verse 20, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand. And he couldn't find her. And he goes up there, and you can read the story for yourself, but he goes up, Hira the Adullamite is a buddy of his, and he goes up there, and he's looking all over, and he says, hey, where's the temple prostitute that was here that sits out here on the roadside? And they said, there isn't one. Nobody works that corner. You know, we don't know. What are you talking about? And so he looks all over, and he can't find her. And he comes back, and he says to him, well, she's not there. And so Judah thinks to himself, well, the kid is worth a whole lot more, you know, financially than the signet ring and the cord and the staff. But if that's all she wants, forget it. I'm just not going to pursue it anymore. We'll just, you know, burn the paperwork and that'll be it. Just don't tell anybody, Hira, that this took place. Just let her keep them. Verse 23. I don't want to be a laughingstock here. I sent the kid up there, and you know, but you couldn't find her. Okay, fine. 3 months go by. And he gets word. Now, she's not in his camp, remember? She's in her dad's camp. But he gets word through the grapevine, which in those camps was real effective. If you remember any of the stories, the grapevine among these places, the gossip system was really good. And it came about that she, at about 3 months, it became obvious she was pregnant. The word got back to him. 3 months later, verse 24, Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, he had no idea how she had played the harlot. She's played the harlot. Behold, she's with child by harlotry. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Can you imagine that? Oh, the righteous indignation. Oh, the steam. He is really steamed. How dare she do this? You know, it's interesting about the double standard in those days. Not entirely gone today regarding who gets away with sexual shenanigans. And they always were much, much more strict on the women than they were on the men. And actually, in several laws in the ancient world, it was punishable by death if a woman who was betrothed... Now, if she had not been betrothed, she was betrothed to one of his sons. If she had not been betrothed, it would not have been the same. But because she was, this was considered adultery, and that was punishable by death. And in very many of these ancient cultures, it was death by burning. So he's going to have her executed. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine what's going on in this man's mind? We think of the patriarchs. We think of them as Sunday school teachers. And these guys, they were men of their world. They were men of their culture. I am not sure I would have liked any of them. Maybe Joseph I would have liked. But I wouldn't have wanted to make any of them angry at me. And it amazes me that God used guys like this who couldn't even get into a Bible college today. Think of this. What an amazing thing. We wouldn't even want him in church. A guy who could get this angry and want to burn this woman and all this righteous indignation. What an incredible hypocrite. Incredible. Verse 25. And she was being brought out, and she sent to her father-in-law, and she said, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Can you imagine what Judah's thinking? I mean, you know, she sends one of her maids or something. They're dragging her out there. Meow, meow, meow. And she stands up and she says, well, take him this stuff. The guy who owns this is the father of my child. And they already know because she didn't put it in a paper bag. They look at this. And they, can you see the looks on these people's faces when they look at this before Judah even sees it? And then they've got to go tell him he's the boss. And they got to go tell him, you remember your signet ring you said you lost, boss? And your staff you said was stolen while you were on that business trip? Look at this, buddy. Can you imagine? I probably wasn't like that, but can you imagine all of it? And all of a sudden, like, he goes like totally red and then white. And then red again, and white again. And he's thinking, oh, no. He recognized them, and he said, she is more righteous than I am, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah. Now, this shortens it. You know it took longer than this. Everything in the Bible takes longer than it takes to read. I mean, they really lived through this. This was a real event. And you can imagine the feeling of absolute rebuke. This chapter should be called The Rebuke of Judah, because that's exactly what it is. It's an absolute rebuke. But I want you to notice how he receives it. He does receive it. Yeah, it was true that he goofed up. It was true that he was immoral. It was true that he was going to let someone else pay the price for it, but he was busted right in the middle of it. And when he was busted, he said, "She's right." Now, he could have stonewalled. He could have attempted. In those days, these kind of guys had almost unlimited power within their circles. And he could have buried the evidence and buried her. And probably nobody would have stopped him in that culture. But he really turns out to be a man with at least a vestige of character left. And he stands up to it and he says, "Nope, she's right. I'm wrong." And he knew immediately why she did it. He said, "I didn't give her my son like I promised her. And the deal I made with her and with her dad so many years ago, I never came through on. And now she's going to have a child. And you know what? The child she's going to have actually turns out to be twins. The children she's going to have are actually mine. They really will be my heirs, just like I told her." Very interesting. He says, "Okay." Now, when she was giving birth, turns out there were twins. Moreover, it took place that while she was giving birth, one put out his hand, and the midwife took it and tied a scarlet thread on his hand and saying, this is the first one. And they had to do that. You know, we don't care. But in those days, they cared which one saw the oxygen first. And even if he went back in again and came back out later, he was the first one. And so they wanted to make sure. So can you imagine this? Here's the midwife going, wait a minute. I see a hand. She ties a little thing on there. And then, he's back. He's gone. Where'd he go? I don't know. And then the other one came out. That's what happened. Amazing birthing process. Verse 29. Came about. He drew back his hand. And then, behold, his brother came out. They're fighting each other. Is this ringing any bells? Isn't it interesting? Did you see the parallels here? They're fighting each other. The first one comes out, then goes back in. Then the second one comes out. And he turns out to be blessed, and we're going to see how that works. Farez is his name, and Zerah is the one with the scarlet thread. And then the story ends. Of course, these men do grow up. They become patriarchs in their own right under Judah. And Tamar, a Canaanite woman who had to trick Judah into making babies with her, ends up being one of the most important people in the Bible, as a matter of fact. This actually, she had no idea of knowing that she would actually be in the line of the Messiah, and that many generations later would come King David from Perez, and then after David, Solomon, and then through Solomon, according to Matthew chapter 1, all the way down to Jesus Christ. One of four women, Tamar was, one of four women in the lineage of Jesus Christ, as it is recorded in Matthew's gospel. All four of them were, or could easily be, accused of immorality. Well, actually, they were, and they were all non-Israelite women, too, incidentally. Amazing that she should be in this list. So the story ends, and we think to ourselves, why in the world is it here? Why is this story in here? Well, let me give you three good reasons why it's here. First of all, because this is the only little bit of information that we have for the 20-year period, okay? And there needs to be something. So it's perfectly appropriate that there should be some sort of account of what happened in that 20-year period to let us know what the spiritual atmosphere was and some of the things going on. Secondly, because Judah was probably already the next son most likely to receive the patriarchal blessing. Now, I won't turn because we're out of time, but check out chapter 49, verses 8 through 10. That's when Jacob is blessing his sons at the end of his life. He goes through Reuben and basically curses him. Simeon and Levi get a curse too because of what they did to Shechem. The next one down is Judah, this man right here. And it says of Judah that the scepter will not depart from the tribe of Judah until Shiloh appears. That is a messianic prophecy that the Messiah would come through Judah. And the handwriting was probably already on the wall. So the writer says, we need to find out, and I need to tell everybody what happened to Judah's family. I need to tell people what happened in Judah. This is not just a weird story that people said, you know, it'd be exciting to tell in church for the next 4,000 years. It's here on purpose because Judah was an important man even at that time. And it was probably obvious to everybody who was, as the family records were being kept. And somewhere along the line, somebody said, we got to put this account in here so people know how it was that Perez was born and what happened and how it was that Tamar was actually part of the scene in the lineage of what eventually became David's line. And finally, because the blessing would eventually result in David's line. That's one of the most important reasons for it. This blessing that about Shiloh and Judah would actually result in Messiah, which I already mentioned to you. So there really are reasons for this story being here. And look at how the Lord uses these people. I want to just mention a couple things as we close, and maybe it'll help you. It has helped me. I love the stories in the Bible where things are not perfect. And there's something sort of dishonest, it seems to me, when we try and make things turn out better than real life all the time. Because the honest reality is that life in a fallen world is a dangerous, messy business. And if God couldn't use the danger and the mess of it all, then what kind of God would we be serving? So let me just mention a couple things that we learn as we close up here. We learn them about the Lord Himself. First is this: the Lord is serious about human responsibility. This is obvious in the passage. He makes these people live up to the agreements and the decisions that they have made, and He still does that today. He is serious about human responsibility, and even to the point of taking human life if necessary because of decisions people make. He took Ur's life. He took Onan's life. He saw to it that Judah was severely rebuked in public for what happened. God is serious about the decisions we make, you guys. He always has been. And it's borne out completely in the New Testament. He's serious about our responsibility to be the people He's called us to be. And we see that clearly in this account. We also see this, that the Lord is successful even through our failures. And both of these chapters are filled with moral failure. In fact, the stories of the patriarchs are all filled with moral failure. And yet God is still successful in bringing His plan about. And the moral failure of the brothers selling their brother into slavery and all this stuff, and they thought he was, for all intents and purposes, dead and gone. They find out years later, 22 years later, they find out that God had a plan in. And we see that. We'll see it as we go along. God knew exactly what was going on. He providentially oversaw the entire messy business. Does that mean He put the thought in their minds? No. He doesn't have to put thoughts in our minds. Bad thoughts just come to our minds. But if we decide to do bad stuff, don't think you're going to goof up God's plan. You know what you're going to goof up? Your life. But you won't goof up God's plan. God will still use that. What you want to do is make good decisions. But now here's the good part. If He can take this bad of a decision, and even in Judah's case, this bad of a decision, and He can do something good out of it, and His plan does not get derailed, imagine all the good He can do with even what we would call honest mistakes of people who are just trying to do God's will and end up goofing it up somehow. Anybody ever do that? Okay. Now you see, you get out, you try and do God's will, and you end up doing something dumb. And I'm not talking about a big sin either, that you do on purpose, and that's more than dumb, that's sinful. But I'm talking when you're really doing the best you can at the time, and you end up saying something stupid or doing something really dumb, and later you think, I offended, I hurt, I didn't mean to, I was trying my best, I was really... And we think, can God use our mistakes? Remember what I said before? If He can't use our mistakes, He'd have nothing to work with. And that's exactly what He's doing here. If He can do this with outright sin and still make it work for His plan, imagine what He can do with even the feeblest attempts that sometimes turn out to be really mistakes on our part, but when we're trying to help and we turn out doing it wrong and we think, I really goofed it all up. I really messed it up for the Lord. You know, you got to remember how smart He is. And if you think you messed it up for Him and you go back and say, Lord, I messed it up for You. Can You do something good with this? I tried to do something good and those people hate me now. And I don't think I'm a very good witness about this, but can You do anything with it? And He says, read chapter 38 of Genesis and tell me if I can do anything good about that. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank You that You can do good things with the dumb things we do. Thank You, Lord, that because of who You are, we can live confidently, not fearful so much of our mistakes, not wanting to sin, not wanting to make bad decisions, in fact, wanting to avoid those. And yet, Lord, still inadvertently goofing things up sometimes. Thank you for reminding us that you are smart enough to deal with all of that and make it work. Because ultimately, Lord, it is your plan that we are interested in more than our own. We thank you for your providence. We thank you for your sovereignty. We thank you for your love. We thank you that you hold us responsible for our decisions, that when we repent, you forgive us, and that you use absolutely everything to move your plan forward. In Jesus' name, amen.